Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the assassination of Russia's ambassador to Turkey at the hands of an off-duty Turkish policeman who shouted, "Don't forget Aleppo and Allahu Akbar," as he opened fire. Aaron Stein, a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, and the Syrian conflict, joins us. We will discuss whether there is a disconnect between President Erdogan's policy of stirring up anti-Americanism while cozying up to Russia, and how the Turkish people feel about Russian atrocities in Aleppo and Syria that are straining Turkish resources on the border as more and more Syrian refugees pour into Turkey to escape the Russian-Iranian Assad offensive to capture Aleppo and the rest of rebel-controlled Syria. Then we'll speak with a veteran former CIA officer, Mel Goodman, about Donald Trump's continuing denial of Russian involvement in helping him win the election, now that it is the consensus of the intelligence community that Putin did indeed intend to hurt Hillary Clinton and help elect Donald Trump. We'll discuss whether Trump, who has trashed the CIA and refuses to take daily briefings, will continue on his collision course and reject the findings of a report on Russian hacking that Obama has ordered released before his term ends and Trump is inaugurated. Then finally, with today's New York Times report finding that there was next to no voter fraud in the recent election, we will speak with David Jefferson, a computer scientist in the Center for Applied Scientific Computing, who sits on the boards of the California Voter Foundation and Verified Voting. He was among the experts who conducted the recount in Wisconsin and was poised to do so in Pennsylvania and Michigan before the Trump campaign sued to stop the recount. We will discuss whether the issue is settled and what remains to be done to secure voting systems in America. And joining us now is Aaron Stein, who is a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, the Syrian conflict, nonproliferation, and the Iran nuclear program. Dr. Stein is currently a doctoral fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, associate fellow for the Royal United Services Institute, and a researcher with the Center for Economic and Foreign Policy Studies, and he previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group in Istanbul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron Stein.
Thank you very much.
So what are we to make of the assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey's capital? He was opening an art exhibition at a modern art center in Ankara, and a retired or an off-duty police officer came up and shot him and shouted, "Don't forget Aleppo, Allahu Akbar," etc., as he opened fire. So this would indicate, at least to me, that given that on the very same day this happened, I think the foreign minister of Turkey was on his way to Russia, if not already there, and Erdogan is trying to repair relations with Putin. So there seems to be a disconnect, perhaps, at the governmental level. You've got the president wanting to work closer with Putin, but you've got people on the ground. So that's my question to you, is there a disconnect between Erdogan's foreign policy vis-a-vis Russians and the street in Turkey? Do the average Turks, are they unhappy, shall we say, with what's happening in Aleppo to their fellow Sunnis?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I wouldn't call it a major disconnect, but certainly on elements within the Erdogan's party, the AKP, particularly on the Islamist right, there is considerable, I'd say, dismay, or people are extremely upset about what's going on inside of Aleppo, and a lot of the images that are coming out of the level of chaos and the casualty numbers there. Most people within the AKP base, I would say, are applauding Turkey's role in trying to successfully brokering a ceasefire with Russia and helping to lead the evacuation of eastern Aleppo after it fell to Russian regime and Iranian forces. But this police officer, his name is Mevlut Akıntaş, who carried out these things, obviously decided to take the law into his own hands, so to speak, and then to exact revenge upon a symbol of the Russian state for the Russian role in bringing the war to Aleppo, and really its out front role, particularly with air power. in helping the regime in Iran and the Iranians take it. And so certainly within certain segments of the Turkish population, there's anger. But I wouldn't call it massive disconnect between the AKP-supporting populace and its recent attempts to try and broker a ceasefire and ease suffering in Syria.
But that's not to say that the AKP itself, and particularly Erdogan, seems to have changed his tune. He was one of the most zealous of the outside players who wanted to bring down Assad, did he not?
Right. I mean, there's been a major recalibration in Turkish foreign policy as it pertains to Syria since this past summer, beginning with a coup attempt in July and then the decision to make amends with Russia. And that's largely based upon an internal calculation inside of Ankara, is that Bashar al-Assad, whether in a negotiated settlement with the United States, Russia, and the various outside actors, or just, you know, Russia itself or any number of outside actors, is likely to survive and not be overthrown, or elements of his regime will simply take his place. And so Turkey switched towards a more narrow strategy inside of Syria, which is to blunt Kurdish expansionism. And in order to do that, they sent troops across the border in August, as they had to win Russian acquiescence to that, lest otherwise risk a major confrontation with a world power. And one of the sort of quid pro quos of this is that the Turks will get their little zone along the border, but Russia will have a free hand in Aleppo. And we're seeing the fruits of that, in that the Russian and the regime and the Iranians were successful, you know, in quotes, in beating the insurgents inside of Aleppo. And then Turkey come late to the game to broker a ceasefire after the battle had been won, to bring a relatively large number of people out of eastern Aleppo for resettlement in other parts of Syria and even inside of Turkey. And so that's a recalibration inside of Turkey about its aims in the war. And you see that manifest itself in both its military action in Syria and how it's dealing with the Russians on a diplomatic level.
But given that Turkey already hosts an enormous number of refugees from Syria, and there's obviously been tensions with Europe over the outflow, and they've sort of struck some kind of a deal. But my sense is that with the fall of Aleppo, and what looks like a impending victory for the Assads, the Russians, and the Iranians, I don't believe that the average Sunni is going to be very comfortable living back in Assad's Syria. And we've already seen a refugee outflow. When the Russians first entered the war, there was a major outflow into Europe. Is there going to be another major Sunni outflow, and presumably much of it, because already Lebanon and Jordan are absolutely overwhelmed. Won't, if there is such an outflow, wouldn't it all end up in Turkey and therefore further strain Turkish resources?
And so that's part of this arrangement, the ceasefire arrangement that Ankara has brokered with Moscow over Aleppo. Is that there is it's a pretty set evacuation route, and that the Turks will then build refugee camps on the Syrian side of the border. So either in Idlib or some will be brought through Turkey and then back into other parts of North Aleppo. And the Turkish policy at the moment is to try and keep them in Syria and then build camps inside of Syria, rather than to allow them into Turkey. Some will certainly come over into Turkey. But, you know, Ankara is doing its best at trying to prevent that, and that is because they are strained. You know, Turkey hosts over 2 million refugees, and they are, you know, and for quite some time now, since mid-2015, it has been the policy of the Turkish government to keep them inside of Syria. And one aspect of this is part of their military operation, which they call Euphrates Shield, is that within territory taken from the Islamic State right along the border, they will try and move some of these people inside of there to create a de facto safe zone for refugees that has both political and military aims, in that that safe zone is blocking Kurdish expansionism and also pushes the Islamic State off their border.
So that's the sort of, let me ask you this. Is Turkey's primary focus on the Kurds? Is that their long view, that that they're going to use the agony in Syria and the refugees that probably won't want to come home as a permanent settlement to drive the Kurds out of that strip along their southern border?
I would say that their primary military goals are to prevent the consolidation of the contiguous Kurdish entity along its longest land border, and that the area in which their military is most active now did not have Kurds in it before they moved forward, was largely occupied by the Islamic State. And so, yes, I think that's part of it. The other is that there is a, I mean, inside Turkey itself, when you go there, I mean, there's a recognition that most of the refugees will not go home for a very long time, if at all. And so preparations are being made, or at least thought through, about what to do about such a large Syrian population inside of Turkey. And to Ankara's credit, you know, they are taking as many steps as possible. I mean, they are a medium-sized power with limited resources to try and provide services to these people. But, they, you know, it's not adequate, and that's not a reflection on Turkish efforts. It's just a reflection on resources. And so this will be a longer-term problem in Turkey. It's the long-term impact of changed demographics along its border with Syria, with such a large influx of Syrian Arabs.
So, and given that the U.S., just in closing, Arenstein, given that the U.S. has found the only reliable boots on the ground are the Kurds, and that Erdogan seems to be doubling down on going after both the YKP and the PKK, and seems to be cozying up to Russia, at the end of the day, is the U.S. going to have any influence there?
Well, this is the big problem that the incoming Trump administration is going to face, is, you know, the Turkish government is extremely upset with U.S. policy inside of Syria because of its close relationship with the Syrian Kurds. And the Trump administration will inherit a ongoing offensive against the Islamic State's a stronghold in Syria of Raqqa. And so the Trump administration will have to decide, does it want to continue with this current strategy, or does it want to change it? And my guess is in the eastern part of Syria, where the war against the Islamic State is taking place, the Trump administration will not alter the strategy all that much, because he will not be amenable to placing U.S. ground forces there, and so the only force left will be the Syrian Kurds. And so you have a cycle of you can foresee problems with Turkey extending to Donald Trump and his administration, linked back to exactly the problems that Barack Obama is having at the moment, which is, what reliable ground force can you use to attack the Islamic State? And that's where we're going to be at, I believe, on January 21st, 2017.
Well, Arenstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Arenstein, who's a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, whose research interests include U.S.-Turkey relations, Turkish foreign policy, the Syrian conflict, nonproliferation, and the Iranian nuclear program. And Dr. Stein is currently a doctoral fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, associate fellow for the Royal United Services Institute, and a researcher with the Center for Economic and Foreign Policy Studies. And he previously worked as a consultant for the International Crisis Group in Istanbul. We're going to take a restation break. We're back speaking with a veteran CIA officer about Donald Trump's continuing denial of Russian involvement in helping him win the election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army, and is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again, although it would be nice to get a call when there was some good news out there.
I think it's going to get worse, frankly.
Well, Garrison Keillor said it'll get worse before it gets worse, and he's my favorite philosopher.
Well, I mean, this is the surreal part. I mean, you've got a president-elect who's picked a fight with the CIA, and from my sources tell me he also picked a fight with the NSA, because the first person who visited him on the first day after he was elected, if indeed he was elected, was Admiral Rogers, the head of the NSA. And apparently Trump started to scream at Rogers about how come you guys are covering up Benghazi. And Rogers kept trying to say, well, there's no there there. I mean, and apparently it ended up with Trump tossing Rogers out, saying you're never going to work in my administration. So not only has he alienated the CIA, apparently he's alienated the National Security Agency as well. So this guy doesn't want to take intelligence briefings. I don't think he wants the job, frankly.
Well, I don't think he has the context for an intelligence briefing. I can't imagine what an intelligence briefing would mean to him, because there's no understanding of any of these international issues. I mean, he doesn't understand our democratic norms, he doesn't understand our democratic institutions, and he doesn't understand international events. And what's really worrisome to me is that the man who's captured his attention is a conspiracy theorist who will be sitting next to him. And that, of course, is General Michael Flynn, who was fired from his job as chief of intelligence for the Defense Intelligence Agency because he was making up his own facts. So it's the combination of his ignorance and then the people who really appeal to him on some basic level, which is where he will seek his advice. You know, at some point, even George W. Bush knew that he was getting some bad advice from Donald Rumsfeld and eventually bad advice from Dick Cheney, and one had to go in terms of Rumsfeld, and Cheney, of course, was quarantined in a sense. But I don't know if Trump is capable of recognizing who can give some good advice to him and who can't. So these are very worrisome times, to say the least.
Well, if there was somebody else in the National Security Council apart from Flynn, at least you'd have some kind of reality check. But with K.T. McFarlane as the deputy, she's just a very ill-informed ideologue from Fox News. She had very tenuous experience in national security affairs. And then you've got Monica Crowley, another Fox News ideologue with no experience in national security. It's not like there's anybody else in the team that they're building.
Well, the team also includes, and this is what, frankly, I worry about, it's a militarization of the national security team. The general who's going to the Pentagon is getting fairly good reviews because he doesn't seem as demagogic and ideological as the others, but I don't think James Mattis should get a waiver to be the Secretary of Defense. The idea of General Kelly, who led our Southern Command for a long time, is going to be given the Department of Homeland Security. Even if you look at the congressman who's been appointed to the CIA, Pompeo, he's a West Point graduate who served in the military in the early 1990s. And the CIA has gone too far in the direction of militarization. And Pompeo has already made it clear that he has real disagreements with the Iranian nuclear agreement, which has been defended by CIA Director John Brennan in an unusual interview he gave to BBC. And of course, Secretary of State John Kerry thanked the CIA for the very good work they did to verify and monitor that arms control agreement. And this is what bothers me about the way Trump has looked at the intelligence community. People have forgotten the value of the intelligence community, what the intelligence community can do when they get it right. And where they've really gotten it right, and I had some experience with this in the 1970s when I worked on the SALT delegation, is verifying and monitoring arms control agreements. And if the CIA cannot do that, there's no way you can convince a Congress to ratify these arms control agreements. So he's turning the entire international security arena upside down, and this is incredibly worrisome.
Well, is there another general as well on the National Security Council? Isn't it Kellogg as well that he's appointed? I think, is a number two or number three in the NSC.
That's not a name I know.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that
All
name.
Right.
But when you look at the principals who will be attending the meeting, this is an extremely militarized group. And I taught at the National War College for 18 years, and I'm very impressed with the military, and I don't subscribe to some of the generalizations made about the military. And the best of them are quite good, but these are tactical officers. These are operational officers. I don't think the military produces great strategic minds or great strategic thought. They don't look for that in the military, and they don't reward it. And I think we've had two examples that have gone well, and that was, of course, General George C. Marshall, who did get a waiver, and up to now the only one who's ever gotten a waiver, to be the Secretary of Defense for Harry Truman in 1947. And, of course, General Brent Scowcroft has been considered the model for a national security advisor when he worked in the George H.W. Bush administration. But when you look at General Flynn, who is known for his outbursts and is known for his rants and his very pugnacious style. One, his job is to give advice to the president. I worry about that. But two, his other job, which is just as important, is coordinating these positions within the national security community. I can't imagine he can do that effectively. And some of the pundits who have praised the Mattis appointment say it's important that he's a four-star general who will have some leadership role over Flynn, who only had three stars. Well, the fact of the matter is, Mattis is going to be on the wrong side of the Potomac River. General Flynn is going to occupy an office next door, essentially, to the president-elect Donald Trump. And this is not a good development at all.
And again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And he's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And of course, you were one of the few people in the CIA that stepped up and testified against the appointment of Bob Gates to be the director of Central Intelligence, saying that he cooked the intelligence over the former Soviet Union and what politicized it. And Gates was on Meet the Press this Sunday, and he said about this issue vis-a-vis the connections between Putin, the Russians, and Donald Trump. He quotes Gates, "I think that given the unprecedented nature of it and the magnitude of it, I think people seem to have been somewhat laid back about it." And I must say, I find it extraordinary that Trump is working overtime to dismiss the connections between him and Putin, which become more and more clear every day. And of course, his excuse and Putin's excuse and the Republicans' excuse is, where's the proof? It's one thing. Nobody doubts that the Russians hacked, but the question is of intent. Was Putin's objective to elect Trump? Now all three of the intelligence heads, that's the FBI, CIA, and the DNI, say that indeed the intent was on Putin's part to elect Trump. So what can be done then? In his press conference, Obama said that he wasn't sure about how much they could release, about what they know, due to sources and methods. So what do you think is going to come down in this kind of standoff? The Trump people are trying to not deny the 900-pound gorilla in the living room. And do you think at some point or other we can get some clarity on this? Because this is the most important issue I think we've ever faced, in the sense that a hostile foreign power may well have helped elect a current or a present-to-be who's about to be inaugurated.
Well, this involves a lot of issues dealing with cyber war, cyber espionage, questions about how far Putin is willing to go in order to antagonize the West and to worsen the relationship with the United States. I still think that Trump's denial of Russian hacking and the impact of any kind of Russian cyber espionage has nothing to do with his feelings toward Putin. It's due to his own narcissism. He cannot accept any explanation for this election situation that suggests that he may have had an unfair advantage in the way the Russians were hacking into the Democratic National Committee and very carefully and slowly and strategically passing out information to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. His narcissism just doesn't allow for that. But at some point, there is going to be a study completed. Obama has asked the intelligence community to complete it by the time he leaves office on January the 20th. all 17 intelligence agencies, now that the FBI and FBI Director Comey has agreed that the Russians were involved in hacking. And I think, if anything, the CIA was very slow to acknowledge, it wasn't until after the election, after all, that what Putin was doing was trying to deny Hillary Clinton the victory. And I've been saying for months that Putin had nothing but contempt for Hillary Clinton. He blamed her for the protests of the parliamentary elections in Russia in 2011. He blamed her for her appointees, even though she had left the State Department by then, but her appointees like Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, who was involved in trying to manipulate the leadership situation in Ukraine in 2014. He certainly blamed Hillary Clinton for misleading him, that is, misleading Putin, about why we were going into Libya in 2011. She denied that there was any attempt here to change the regime and to target Gaddafi, but that's exactly what the goal and mission of the United States and NATO was all about. And, of course, she made this outrageously arrogant statement about we came, we saw, and he died after Gaddafi was killed. Putin was furious about all of this. And what I think the United States has to understand, since it believes itself to be an exceptional power and dotes on its own exceptionalism, well, Putin has an idea of Russian exceptionalism as well. And Russian exceptionalism means that they're a Eurasian power, and they're going to control or have great influence over those regions that are close to them. And we clearly crossed all sorts of red lines with regard to Ukraine, with regard to Georgia, putting a missile defense in Poland and Romania, abolishing the ABM treaty, expanding NATO after we gave the assurance that we would not leapfrog over East Germany to go into Eastern Europe. So Putin has a serious list of grievances he has with the United States, and this has to be recognized. And cyber war, when you look at cyber war, the most outrageous use of the cyber technology has been what the United States and Israel did to Iran in 2008 and 2009. And that's the first time, and actually I think it's the only time that I can recall, that cyber espionage included the destruction of equipment that computers controlled. We've seen cyber techniques that steal information. That's certainly what was done to the Democratic National Committee, or hijacking computers, which the Russians have done in Germany, they've done in Estonia, and they've done in Georgia. But what we did in Iran, I thought, was a very dangerous precedent. And the other puzzle about this to me is, if you look at President Obama's reaction to what the North Koreans did to Sony a couple of years ago, he was far more involved and far more emotional about that than he was about the Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. So clearly this shouldn't have been ignored, but it was. The first warning that the FBI gave to the Democratic National Committee was a phone call in the summer of 2015, more than a year ago, which the Democratic National Committee did nothing about. This is an extremely serious matter. If Putin is willing to take on the United States in this way without any concern, apparently, about the consequences of such involvement. And I agree with President Obama. You know, nothing happens in Moscow without Putin being involved in it. That's the kind of political system that it is. But to just respond without thinking about the consequences, I think, could be very dangerous. What we really need are the kind of confidence-building measures you see in other areas. And we've talked to China about cyber warfare, and apparently there is some agreement between the United States and China about what is permissible and what is off-limits. We have confidence-building measures in naval maneuvers. We have confidence-building measures in nuclear maneuvers. Why can't you have confidence-building measures in this whole area of cyber technology and cyber security? And all of this points to what is really essential, and actually Donald Trump, of all people, did refer to this, that's the need for restoring the Russian-American dialogue. The idea that these two nuclear powers with thousands of nuclear weapons between them, far more than any other group of nations can claim, do not have a dialogue, and even more, an institutionalized dialogue, I think is outrageous. You have a Secretary of Defense in this country, Ash Carter, who has told his subordinates that he doesn't want them communicating with his counterparts in Russia. Well, that makes no sense to me whatsoever, particularly in these times when you look at the problems that the United States and Russia have mutual solutions on with regard to terrorism, with regard to proliferation, with regard to nuclear powers, with regard to all sorts of transnational problems that are bedeviling the international community. So it's time for a new rule book. It's time for the United States and Russia to get back to the table, and it's time to negotiate a lot of these issues. Just to strike back, to me, without thinking of the consequences, makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, Mel, though, given that the FBI now backs the CIA assessment that Russia deliberately tipped the election in favor of Trump, and that what we're really waiting for is this presidential report that's going to come out before Obama leaves and Trump's inaugurated. I mean, let's assume that since everybody agrees that this happened, and that does bring into question Trump's legitimacy, because the election was so close. We know the FBI director probably helped tip the scale as well as Putin. But assuming that it basically says that Putin has helped elect our president, surely how can this guy take office? And I mean, apart from the fact that he himself apparently is completely out to lunch, doesn't want to take intelligence briefings, is holed up in Trump Tower, watches TV all day and gets mad at these pundits talking about him if he doesn't agree with them and tweets in the middle of the night. He seems like he doesn't want the job, he doesn't want to do the job. And on top of that, he didn't really get elected. So,
well, I just don't go that far. When I put together a list of why Hillary Clinton lost the election, and it's a very long list.
I agree with you entirely.
I would put this hacking at the very, very bottom.
Right.
But far more serious to me, and what will need to be done, but it won't be done in a Trump administration, is what in the world the FBI director thought he was doing in July, October, and November. When he won, he basically indicted her in July, even though he said she was merely careless. And then in October, I had already voted when he made this statement on October 28th because Maryland has early voting. So he interfered in an election that had already begun.
Right.
And then he writes a letter to the Congress a week later saying, oh, never mind, I didn't mean what I said in the earlier letter. So there's a long list of reasons why she lost the election in terms of not even taking good political advice from her husband, who's right, probably one of the master politicians of our generation. Now, I agree that the hacking cannot be ignored, but that's a problem of Russian-American relations that have been severely harmed over the last 20 years, frankly, starting with Hillary Clinton's husband when he decided he would expand NATO for domestic political reasons to deprive Bob Dole, of all people, of an electoral challenge in the 1996 race for the presidency. So I wouldn't look at this as an indictment of Trump's legitimacy. The indictment of his legitimacy can be seen in the popular vote, where she obtained nearly 3 million more votes than
right,
he did. But if we have an electoral system that really speaks to the pseudo-democracy that we have, because the Founding Fathers were really not Democrats in any way, and that's what the Electoral College was designed to protect, not to allow the rabble to determine who the president would be. That's a problem that needs to be addressed, because it can only be addressed with a constitutional amendment, and that's certainly not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We're stuck with this president.
Right, but I was basically asking you, though, Mel, let's assume that when this evidence comes out, that Trump's calling for, that Putin's calling for, that the Republicans and all the supporters of Trump, and if the intelligence community say, yes, it happened, yes, Putin did tip the scales, yes, he did interfere, yes, he did want to hurt Hillary, as you've pointed out, and wanted to help Trump. Let's assume that the evidence comes out and it's pretty irrefutable. What happens then?
Well, when I look at Donald Trump's personality, I can't see him as the kind of narcissist that he is, admitting that he may have been wrong about something. He will deny this report, just as he's denied all of these accusations, and he's denied the assessment provided by the intelligence community and all the briefings that have been given to the Senate and the House over the last few weeks. So at some point, this issue will go away, I think. I don't think it's going to remain, because the real issue and the real debate and it could even be a bipartisan agreement here, is what do we do about Russia, not what do we do about Donald Trump. We are stuck with Donald Trump. I haven't looked at the news today because I know the Electoral College is voting. My guess is they've already given him his more than 270 electoral votes that he needs to be declared the president of the United States. That battle is over. The real battle now will be a foreign policy issue over what do we do about Moscow, what do we do about Putin, and actually, what do we do about getting Russian-American relations back on track? Because if you look at what's happening in the world today, including the political assassination of the Russian ambassador in Istanbul and the terrible act of terrorism, apparently, that took place in Berlin, we're looking at very apocalyptic scenarios, because the Middle East is just going to continue to get worse. When you look at Aleppo, that's the symbol of the kind of apocalypse that we're living in right now. So at some point, we have to restore some sense of order in the international community. And I'm not impressed with the kinds of people that Donald Trump has put around him. But if you have an important bipartisan discussion, and the model for me would have been, not that it was a successful model, what Fulbright was trying to do in this country in the mid-1960s when we were going off immorally and illegally into Vietnam, where 55,000 Americans and who knows how many hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of Vietnamese died. We have to save the United States from really going off the brink by a president who seems to move randomly and typically by the seat of his pants. So I think some consensus in the Senate with the leading actors of the Senate, both on the Republican and Democratic sides of the aisle, will go a long way to restoring some semblance of order in this foreign policy community. Right now, I'm concerned about the fact that Trump will listen to no one. And even Obama, I noticed in the last press conference, now he's starting to lecture Donald Trump. He's not assuming that everything will happen in the best of all possible worlds, that it will be very sobering for him to come into the White House, and that the Oval Office has a sobering impact on the people who occupy the Oval Office. I don't think Obama believes that anymore. I think Obama is worried.
Well, I think he knows.
I think a lot of us feel a certain sense of despair about right. What is happening right now.
No, this is a scary situation, and I don't know what we can do about it. We've never had anybody so ill-qualified and disinterested in the very job that he has. I thank you for joining us, Mel Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army, and he's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into today's New York Times report that finds that there was next to no voter fraud in the recent election.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Jefferson, who's a computer scientist at the Center for Applied Scientific Computing, who previously spent 7 years in Silicon Valley at the DEC Compaq HP Labs working on election security. He has served and continues to serve on a number of government panels at the state and federal levels advising on election security issues, especially with regard to electronic and internet voting. He also sits on the board of directors of the California Voter Foundation and Verified Voting. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Jefferson.
Thank you very much.
And David, the New York Times is carrying a front page story on Monday saying that all this talk of voter fraud across the U.S. officials found next to none. So basically what they're saying is all of what Donald Trump said about the voting being rigged and that millions of people voted for Hillary Clinton that were illegal, et cetera. And on the other side of the political spectrum, there was all lots of talk about voter suppression. But according to election officials across the country, there's little to no evidence of any problems. You worked on the recount in Wisconsin. So let's start there. First of all, do you agree with the overall premise that there wasn't too many problems and certainly no fraud or no fraud to speak of in this election?
Well, first let me say that those of us who were behind the recount in Wisconsin did not go in with the expectation that we would find any fraud. We were concerned, however, considering the Russian cyber attacks on the Democratic National Committee and on John Podesta's email and cyber attacks on various voter registration databases in the country in up to 20 states. We were concerned that there was a possibility that there might have been cyber attacks on the balloting and canvas process itself, and we wanted to check. So we were able to complete a mixed kind of recount in Wisconsin. Some of the counties actually counted from the original paper ballots, which is the right way to do it. Some of them re-scanned the paper ballots using the same systems that counted the ballots in the first place, and that's not the way we wanted to have it done. And the answer is that we are still analyzing the data that we have from and collecting more of the data from the recounts in Wisconsin. But so far, we do not have any evidence that there was any cyber attack in Wisconsin. Now, I say so far, we're not finished, and there's always a possibility that we will find something to concern us later. So we're not making a definitive statement yet. Certainly I'm not. But I can say that we haven't found any yet. So that's Wisconsin. And we were also attempting a recount in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. And as you probably know, the courts ended up terminating those efforts before they got very far at all. And so we're not going to be able to say anything about the possibility of remote cyber attack manipulation of the elections in those states. Again, we don't have any evidence that there was any. We just wanted to check, and our attempt at checking has been killed by the courts.
Well, don't you find it a little ironic, David Jefferson, that here we have in the national debate at the moment questions about the role of Vladimir Putin in helping Donald Trump win the presidency and hurting Hillary Clinton. And now apparently the top intelligence people in this country have come to a consensus that indeed not only was Russian hacking for real, they believe on the issue of intent that Vladimir Putin did indeed intend to swing the election for Donald Trump, and that the last to join in that consensus has been the FBI. So that is a consensus from the intelligence community. The President of the United States has asked for an inquiry to get to his desk before he leaves office. Why, excuse me, I was about to say why in the hell, but why didn't all of these people step in earlier if they knew that this had been going on and join in your effort?
Well, I can't speak for why some parties did not join our effort and others did. I can say that I would say the biggest barrier to our recount effort was the poorly structured recount laws that are a patchwork of I guess I would have to say, conceptually mistaken laws. And so these prevent us from doing what we needed to do. For example, in Wisconsin, when you ask for a recount, you can ask for them to count from the original paper ballots, but it's entirely up to county election officials whether they do that or not. And some counties did and some counties did not, and there was nothing we could do about that under the law in Wisconsin. In Pennsylvania, most of the counties representing most of the population of Pennsylvania doesn't even have paper ballots. There weren't paper ballots to recount. All you could do in a recount in Pennsylvania is to rerun the same software over the same electronic records of ballots and see if you get the same results. Well, of course, you would. So what we asked for, what we asked the court for, was to be able to do a forensic examination of the computers, the voting machines, and the canvas systems that participated, so we could see if there was any evidence of remote cyber attack or malicious software. And there just isn't any provision for that in Pennsylvania law, and the courts could not find it a reason for to support it under the law. So I'm not being terribly critical of the court in Pennsylvania. I don't know that they had a lot of choice the way the laws are written, but the laws should be written so that if there is a controversy and somebody's willing to pay for the recount, then it should be possible to do the recount. The law should not be written to construct barriers to recounts or audits of elections. The laws should be structured so as to encourage them. In fact, our position, and by us I mean the computer security community of election experts, and also Verified Voting, the organization, another organization that I'm on the board of directors of, our position is that there should be routine audits of every election from the original paper ballots, and that should just be routine, so that there is, with routine audits from the original paper ballots, there is little or no possibility that a cyber attack, even a hidden, clever, sophisticated one, can affect the outcome of the election. And so that's what we were trying to demonstrate, is that principle. And unfortunately, at least in two of the states that we tried, we were unsuccessful in making the case that that's what we should have done.
Well, you're also opposed by the Trump campaign in the courts.
We were, and it's not clear whether. So it's unfortunate that we were opposed by any of the campaigns or by anyone. But even if they had not opposed us, it's possible that the courts would have ruled against us anyway, because the laws in those two states really don't favor recounts. And there's no precedent for under the law for being able to get forensic access to the voting machines in Pennsylvania. We think there's a legal principle that justifies it, but it's not very explicit, and the court did not agree.
But in terms of foreign hacking, and we know that the Russians did a couple of test runs in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Was it Arizona? I can't remember the two states that they probed.
Illinois and Arizona.
Yeah, and so where the Homeland Security was alerted to that. Again, I'm puzzled why you didn't have more support from the very government that now telling us that the Russians did indeed interfere in our elections. So, you know, and my understanding is that the way that anything that goes across the internet is when you're vulnerable, and that's why touchscreens are vulnerable. And I think, 2/3 of the voting machines in Pennsylvania are touchscreens, aren't they? They're not the optical scanners.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, so they are. But so we have to be careful about because the election officials will tell you that these systems are not, in fact, connected to the internet. And we argue that position is mostly false. That is, that from time to time, they are connected to things that are connected to the internet. So we have to be careful. That's a longer discussion, which we don't want to get into, a technical discussion about the internet. And I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, I was going to say that given that it's too complicated to talk about, it's a known fact that of all the voting machines in this country, and there's, as you point out, there's a patchwork not only of laws, but there's a patchwork of voting equipment, that the most vulnerable are the touchscreens.
Well, they are among the voting machines in precincts. Those are the most vulnerable. But right. There are other vulnerabilities that don't involve those machines. The machines that are used to accumulate all the votes from the many touchscreen machines or many scanners in a given jurisdiction, the machines that are used to accumulate all those votes, the canvas machines, those are also subject to remote attack if they are even intermittently connected to the Internet, or even if they're not. And so we have to be careful about all of these systems. And the best way is to is not to rely on hardening or securing those systems. I mean, that's a good thing to do. You certainly want to do that. But there's no way to harden them enough to make them invulnerable to remote cyber attack. So what we are asking is that states adopt, first of all states adopt paper ballot systems and get rid of the paperless direct recording electronic voting machines that are still prevalent in a number of eastern states, including Pennsylvania. First of all, so get rid of those machines and reinstitute paper ballots everywhere in the United States. And then after the election, even though those paper ballots are initially counted by machine, we need an auditing process, a sampling process, which goes back to the original paper ballots eyeballed by humans, and to check that the results from at least a large sample of the paper ballots match those produced by the machines. And if that's the case, we would be satisfied that there wasn't any cyber attack involved.
Again, though, David, my puzzlement is that you didn't get more support because, for example, in the recent and last press conference that President Obama gave, he talked at length about Russian hacking, and he also said that he personally, when he met with Putin in China a few months back, he pulled Putin over and personally warned him about screwing with our elections. Now, apparently, his excuse, Obama's excuse for not coming out more forcefully earlier, was that one, he didn't want to appear partisan, and two, he had warned Putin against doing it. And the reason that he didn't want to go public was that, in effect, he said that he didn't want Putin hacking our elections in the way that you were searching for. In other words, he didn't want them to really turn their efforts into altering the results in these vulnerable areas like in Pennsylvania. And
the president went even further. The president said that he is satisfied that the Russians did not interfere with the balloting and canvas processes. Right. And I think the president actually overstepped there, because I don't believe he or the intelligence community can actually know that. They argued that they saw no increased cyber activity on election day that would be a signal for remote manipulation of the vote processes. But that's a pretty weak statement, though. A remote cyber attack can occur in advance of election day, and you wouldn't necessarily see any activity at all on election day, and you could still have affected the vote counts and put the Russian thumb on the scale, or somebody else's thumb on the scale, of our election. So I think the president actually overstated it there, and I don't know whether this was he's just trying to reassure the country, or whether he just has mistaken information from his advisors. I rather suspect it's the latter. And on this point, I don't agree with the president. I mean, we still do not know, until we check, whether there was any kind of remote cyber attack. We do know, as you said earlier, that the Russians did attack several of our electoral institutions, and somebody attacked, probably the Russians, the statewide voter registration databases in at least two states, and probed up to 20 others. And somebody has apparently conducted remote attacks on the Secretary of State's offices in several states now, and I haven't heard the final word on that. But it just makes it perfectly clear that our election systems are way too vulnerable to cyber attack. Even if we ever find out and can say with some certainty that the voting was not attacked this time, it's clear now, as it has never been before, that these systems are vulnerable to that kind of attack, and there are actors out there who can and are motivated to conduct such attacks, and we just have to fix these systems so that that's not possible.
Well, just in closing, though, my critique of the president would be that if you know that Vladimir Putin has already hacked your elections and he's gone after the DNC and John Podesta's emails, and that's what the intelligence people have told you already, and you go and talk to this guy and say, don't go any further and don't hack the actual results themselves, it's a bit like asking an arsonist who your neighbor's house is on fire, and you basically say to him, well, I'm not going to tell anybody that you set my neighbor's house on fire as long as you don't set my house on fire.
Yeah. Well, yes. So we don't know exactly how that conversation went down between the president and Putin, but apparently President Putin was not strongly influenced by it. At least that's what would appear from what I've seen in the newspaper. So, yeah, it's a real problem. I have to say that there was, given the way the voting systems are built today and the way they are managed and the lack of paper ballots in a number of states and the lack of strong recount or strong auditing laws, frankly, there was little the president could do in the short time since summer. That could have prevented this anyway, or could have prevented a problem anyway. There just wasn't much that could be done. The systems have to be re-architected and rethought, and the procedures for managing both voter registration and voting have to be rebuilt so that they are totally invulnerable to remote cyber attack, not just from the Russians or the Chinese, but also from our own internal partisans.
Well, David Jefferson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Jefferson, who's a computer scientist in the Center for Applied Scientific Computing, who previously spent 7 years in Silicon Valley at the DEC Compaq HP Labs working on election security. He has served and continues to serve on a number of government panels at the state and federal levels, advising on election security issues, especially with regard to electronic and internet voting. He also sits on the board of directors of the California Voting Foundation and Verified Voting. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.